Hi, welcome back to Voices from the Road. I'm Jennifer Robinson, and today I have two guests with me. I have Noir.
Hi, Jennifer.
Noir is my colleague and friend who is currently working in Iraq, and I'm with my co-host, Jessica.
Hi.
So today we're going to be talking with Noir about his experience of being Syrian and working in Iraq, and also a trip that he recently took to Europe as a tourist, just for fun. And I have Jessica with me because she's going to help me maybe ask some questions that I wouldn't think of, because I know you really well, Noir, and Jessica has sort of like the outsider's perspective, so we wanted to be able to have maybe her questions, because she might think of something that, I wouldn't think of.
Hopefully.
Yeah, it seems a good idea, but.
So, actually, Jessica, you feel like you already know a little bit of Noir's story, because I came and visited you last year, and I had already told you a little bit of it. Plus, I've already written about Noir in my blog once or twice before.
Mm-hmm. And I even wrote about Noir once.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You wrote a poem?
No, I wrote a blog post, and I was writing mostly about you, Jennifer, but one of the things I said about you is that what you're passionate about is sharing stories of your friends, and the friend I referenced was Noir, and just a few pieces of the story that I had already heard.
This is true, really.
Yeah, so I guess it's come full circle. Here we get to do, like, the group story sharing. Okay, so...
Yeah.
So, Noir, when did you come to Iraq?
Well, the first I arrived was October the 6th, 2012. So, it was the first day that I arrived to Iraq, Erbil, in the north of Iraq.
So, that was almost 4 years ago.
Yeah, more or less 4 years ago, 3 years and 8 months, yeah.
And you came from, you had lived in Damascus.
Yep, I have I've lived in Damascus for the whole my life since I was born, and then the first place that I went out of Syria to work was Iraq, here in Erbil.
And the war in Damascus or in Syria had started in 2011, correct?
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, the war started in 2011. It was mid of March, basically.
Why did you leave Syria? Was it because of the war, or was it for some other reason?
Yeah, in a way or another, when the war became more crazy, and the area that we were living was surrounded by all these militias and these groups, so it was better just to leave, because especially that I was I finished my master at that time, and I was waiting I was waiting for the approval to start the PhD, but then it takes time for 6 months. So I thought, okay, it's better to have a kind of residency outside of Syria, so I can postpone my military services. So I can postpone it for a year. Then I can come back to finish my PhD or start my PhD there.
What was your master's degree in, and what were you hoping to do your PhD in?
Yeah, I studied political sciences, and then in the master's degree was about international economic relations. For the PhD, I was applying for international relations, public relations and this stuff, but globally, let's say.
Okay, and you thought it would be a good time to leave, you said, to postpone your military duty. Are you able to say anything about that? For example, what is the military duty?
Yeah, the military duty in Syria, it's about guys, they have to serve the army for people who are guys who are not educated, so they have to serve the army for 2 years and a half, while for for guys who are graduated from the college, they have to serve for one year and a half. During the war, it became it's just although that you finished the 1 year and a half, but the government is going to keep you just because of the war. So it could be for 3 years, could be for 5 years, God knows when it ends. Some people that they served the military in 2012, and so far they still are in the army services because they cannot really leave it. And I thought that I'm not ready for this. I wanted to continue my studies. I wanted to continue my career. So I thought that it's not the time, the good time to serve the military here or like to do the military duty.
So Nawar, then when you came to Iraq in 2012, you weren't coming as a refugee.
No, obviously not. I came here just like, because there is a law in Syria. If you get residency outside of Syria for 1 year, so when you come back to Syria, you could easily postpone your military duty. So because of this, and you have to pay some taxes or like fees, which is like small amount of money, which was in my situation perfect because and like there was this 6 month gap between the master degree and the PhD, let's say. So I needed just only 6 months. Anyway, I thought, okay, I can postpone for 1 year so I can continue my PhD. And according to the PhD, I could postpone my military services for 5 years.
Okay, so then if you're comfortable, can you just tell us a little bit about what was happening right around the time that you left?
Yeah, at that time, I was engaged, and I went to Jordan before coming to Erbil. So I left Syria, was September 27th, 2012. I spent like around 9 days in my ex-fiancé place with her. She used to live with her mother and her brother.
In Amman, Jordan.
So, and right after that, it's just like I flew to from Amman to Erbil directly. At that time, the day that I flew, it's just like, or a night before, like I was talking to my older, my younger brother, also with all my family at that time, telling them that, okay, tomorrow I'm leaving to Erbil. So the day after, the flight was at 4:30. On the way to the airport, I called my parents, my mom, my dad, and I checked about my brother, my younger brother. Anyway, they didn't tell me, like, they weren't clear or honest about, like, where is my brother. So I thought there is something happening or something wrong is happening. When I landed, I just directly called them, and then, like, they told me some stories about him that he's fine but maybe arrested or something. Anyway, wasn't the truth, because after 2 days being in Erbil, he passed away, and I knew that he passed away. And because on the day, on the 6th of October, the day that I arrived to Erbil, he got injured by mortar or like kind of shelling or airstrike or something. So
That happened near to a shop that your family owned, a gallery, right? Because your family was in the business of selling ceramics?
Yeah, ceramics, porcelain items, exporting, importing these kind of construction materials for interior decorations or designing. So, yeah, at that time, my dad and my brother went to check on the gallery, because for a week before was like not, was not, they were not able to access the area because it was kind of hot area or something. And at the day that they went to Harasta, the area, which is called...
Harasta is the neighborhood.
The neighborhood is Harasta. When they went there... it was announced that it's fine now to go and for people to go to collect some stuff, because a lot of people just left their houses and just like went to some relatives. So it was a chance to just like collect some stuff, their clothes or whatever, to could like so they could live for longer time outside of their houses or shops or whatever. So at that time, my dad and my brother went there for this, to check on the galleries, both of them, and the house, and also the store. Anyway, they could check the first gallery. There was just only the glass wall broken, while my brother was like trying to get the glass away of the street beside the walk side.
The sidewalk.
The sidewalk, sorry. So it was there was like this kind of bombing or something like this. So I get something
a shrapnel or a piece of glass shrapnel, or something.
Yeah, in his back neck or something.
The back of the head, right? Like
the back of the head. Yeah. And then he went in a coma for 3 days, and on the 9th of October 2012, it was Tuesday, he passed away.
And you were just in the process of moving to Erbil from Amman, and you just didn't have any idea for those whole 3 days that he was in the coma. You didn't know what had happened.
No, nobody told me, and it was in a way or another, I feel like it wasn't fair because I could just drive back from Amman to Syria, just to see him or something, at least to have the opportunity or the chance to say goodbye or something. Mm-hmm. Just I felt a bit wasn't fair to, so I wasn't aware about what's going on there for 3 days. And it's just by chance I knew that he passed away by a message I received from a friend of mine that was sent on my Syrian number, which used to be working at that time.
A text message. You received a text message from a friend. Yeah. It wasn't even, you didn't hear about it from your family.
No. Didn't hear about it. But I had this feeling, because two of my relatives, one, my aunt from Canada, my cousin from Dubai called me in the midday, which usually or normally they used during these 3 days before they used to call me in the night time or the evening time, not in the midday. However, they didn't know at that time when we communicated later, we talked about this, they didn't know that my brother already passed away, but just by chance they called me at that time. I was 2 minutes differences between my cousin from Dubai and my aunt from Canada calling me. So I think there is something wrong here. And then in a minute after or something, I received the text from my friend.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about this a little bit. Your family didn't tell you because they didn't want you to come back. Like they wanted you to go to Erbil, even though you weren't going as a refugee. They just didn't want you to come back.
Well, actually, at the beginning, my dad didn't like the idea that I'm leaving before the incident happened. So the fact that I'm going to go from Syria to Erbil, my dad didn't like it at the beginning, but then it's my choice. So I just went. But then after when the incident happened, they didn't want me to come back absolutely because I'm the only son now for them. And it's just I should not be back anymore. And at that time, they both, my parents both said it was a good idea that I left to Erbil because it could be the three of us there, my dad, me, my brother, in the same time. So God knows what could happen at that moment.
Right, what would have happened if you had been there?
Yeah, true.
So you arrive in Erbil in 2012. You said, which month was it, September or October?
It was October.
October. And what was going on in Erbil at the time? I think you took a job working at an electronics store. You had a couple of jobs, and you did those for a few months. But you also started volunteering with an NGO. I think it was Un Pont Pairs.
Un Pont Pair means in English, it's Italian NGO, and in English means Bridge 2.
Bridge 2. And so you started volunteering for them in what month?
In September 2013, so after almost a year.
So almost a year later, in 2013, is that when the Syrian refugees started coming?
Yeah, they started, Syrian refugees started, I heard about Syrian refugees started to come between March, May 2013, but everything I heard was about the hook in these two camps there, Domiz 1, Domiz 2.
So Duhok is in northern Iraq.
Yeah, this is true, which is away 2 hours away of Erbil by car.
So you hadn't gone to visit those camps. You weren't really familiar. So you're just living your life, working.
Yeah, this is true. I used to work with these two companies, one for electronic store and the other one was for oil services as a part-time at that time. But then I quit my job in the evening, which is the one with the oil services company or the logistic company. let's say in July, and then in September I decided to volunteer with one of these NGOs, which is Un Punto Per, UPP, let's say, to serve the Syrian people, because I heard, like, starting from June, July, Syrian refugees started to move to Erbil, or the government started to resettle them in Erbil.
And the work you did for this NGO was mostly administrative, and you also did translation work for them.
Yeah, this is true. Since, like, I had my work in the electronic store at the morning, so obviously I cannot go to the field. So mostly it was like between 5 to 12 midnight or 11 midnight, about administrative work, translation, and some internal evaluation and auditing. Well, it wasn't like on daily basis, but when there is a need. So mostly it can be three, 4 days per week, between 2 to 4 days per week, let's say.
And what was your motivation for wanting to volunteer?
Well, the point is that I wanted to help my people. I felt like there is a need to help them, to provide help for free. So this is the most what motivated me to do this job for free. Although that I was offered twice to be working with UPP, but I already have my job, which is good at that moment. I wanted to do something just only for free.
What was it like for you when you first went to one of the camps and started to do the work you were doing with Syrian refugees?
Yeah, well, with UPP, I didn't visit any camp. So let's say 5 months later, I started to work officially or in professional, as a professional career with International Medical Corps, the IMC. So at that time, I kept my volunteering job with EPP, but also now I have professional career with IMC.
So Nawar, let me just jump in. So you kept volunteering. And then you didn't take a job with UPP, but you eventually decided to quit your job with Panasonic and to go into this professionally. So you stopped being a volunteer, and you were hired as a local or a national staff, is what we say, by IMC, which is International Medical Corps.
Exactly. It was like that. And started to work with them in March.
March of 2014.
14, yeah. Now we're talking about March 2014. So started to work with them. First, we were trained by the regional advisor for GBV, gender-based violence, with IMC. It was April. And when we talk about the topic GBV, it just, like, for me was kind of weird, because in Syria, like, I used to know that the girls are more educated than the guys in the university. You could see girls more than the guys. Also in the work, you could see girls more than the guys. So whenever the trainer, like, used to talk about GBV, what is the concept of GBV, the gender-based violence, and these topics, I thought for Syrian refugees it's something like, you know, obvious, like, it's not like that. But then when...
You didn't believe it. You didn't believe that gender-based violence was happening in the camps.
Exactly. They didn't believe it, that it's happening in Syria, not in the camp.
In the
refugee's life, it could be, but what I thought that for, like, with Syrians, like, they are well educated, so no. But then when I started to go to do field work, it's just like I was surprised, and I thought seriously, like, it was needed. This training was needed, and we need this something. So we all learn.
And then what was it like the first time one of the first camps you went to was called Dar Shakran, and that's in Erbil.
Yeah.
And it's actually a camp that was managed by my agency, the Danish Refugee Council. No, that was acted. Actually, I'm not correct. Forgive me.
At that time, yes, was acted, not DRC. But then DRC took over the camp management in 2015. But 2014 was managed by acted. And I still remember that Italian guy, the camp manager. So it was my first time going to the camp with my colleague. And I really want to mention her name, if it's fine, Stephanie. So we went there for NFI distribution, non-food items.
So that is something like, that can be kitchen pots and pans. It can be plastic sheets, blankets. What were you distributing?
At that moment, the items were hygiene items.
Hygiene. So that's like soap, toothpaste.
Exactly. Toothpaste, toothbrush, nail trimmers, or like these kind of materials.
It can include sanitary pads for women.
This is true. Yeah, sanitary bands, and also bands for kids, for children.
Diapers.
Yeah, diapers.
Because those are all things that can be really hard to get or cost a lot of money, and that's something difficult when you're a refugee, right?
This is true. Especially it's not easy for them to move outside of the camp. It wasn't easy for them. And it's not like these kind of items are not always available in the shops inside the camp.
So what was that first distribution like for you?
So it was this distribution about NFI or non-food items. And at that time, I still remember the moment that on the way going there, and I had this mixed feeling in me, going to a refugee camp for the first time in my life as a camp. And at that camp was for Syrian refugees, which is for me was kind of weird, because in Syria, we used to host refugees from different countries, from if I can mention, from Palestine, from Lebanon, Iraq, from Somalia, Sudan, some Egyptians. And also, recently I was studying, I was reading something about the history in the Second World War. So many European countries, or many European people were hosted by Syrians in Syria. So it was, at that time, was weird for me, to become a refugee after being a host for refugees, you know? So I had this mixed feeling. I didn't know that if I'm going to handle it or not. And then I arrived. I do remember that it was full of super emotional moments, you know? You want to really cry, but you don't want to show your tears in front of your colleagues. You don't want to look like you are a weak person. You are not for this job, you know? But also, from your voice, it was obvious that there is something stuck in your throat or something, you know? It's just you really cannot talk in normal way. Mm. Yeah.
And then, okay, so that's March. And you meet me probably just a couple months later in June, right? June of 2014. Yeah. That's when I moved to Erbil.
This is true. The distribution was actually by the end of April. But then the program we had with IMC was a multi-sectoral program, so about health, about hygiene promotion, about protection, GBV, child protection, youth empowerment, multi-sectoral project for the refugee, for the Syrian refugees, in the camp, not in urban areas. So, which means the four refugee camps at that time, which are Dar al-Shakran,
Kawargosk, Kushtapa, and Basirma, which is where I ended up working in Basirma camp. And you did too. You ended up focusing on Basirma and Kushtapa, right?
Yeah, this is true. So the first time I met you, Jen, was June. It was June 2014. I had a meeting with the camp manager, the previous camp manager, the one used to manage the camp before you arrived, before you came. about registering our agency or our organization in Basir Makam and try to get space to provide our services plus our health services. So it was that time.
Right. So for people who don't know what camp management is, so my role was in camp management, your role was in health, and the camp manager of a camp is sort of responsible for coordinating the services to make sure that different NGOs do have a space in the camp, like a literal space, whether it's a caravan or it's a certain area, you know, certain number of meters by another certain number of meters.
Yeah.
And also to make sure that the services that are being provided meet international standards, because we do have standards.
Yeah, this is true. And also one of the things that you did perfectly, Jen, was to avoid overlapping and duplication.
Yes, exactly. So to make sure that we, because, for example, our camp might have three different agencies who all want to do child protection, and there might be another camp that doesn't have anyone doing child protection. So it's the camp manager's job to sort of say, hey, guys, we need you to go focus on this other place.
This is true, yeah. It happened a lot. Like when we tried to register our agency, it happens with us when we talk about some services, they ask us to provide it in different areas because these services are already provided in this camp or that.
And the NGO who's doing camp management works together with the government as well as the UN to make those sort of recommendations.
This is true. Yeah, this is true. So all camp manager, let's say, agencies who are providing the service or the service are all on the same page all together. So I do remember that, or I do know that there is a kind of CCM cluster working group. So they all are on the same page, exactly as we do have here, like the protection cluster group or the health cluster group or the education cluster group.
Right. And so basically that's when you and I started working together. Like we would have every 2 weeks, we'd have a meeting with the local mayor of Basirma, and we'd come, all the NGOs would come, and we would discuss the activities that we're all doing. And that's how...
Involving the camp council, which is kind of body established in Basirma and composed of people from the camp themselves. So... So we can be all on one page or together, like, so that they can, like, you know, identify the needs, kind of handing over the responsibility to the camp residents about to discuss their issues.
Right. And that's something we really worked hard at, to make sure that the local leaders of the camp, both women and men and youth, were coming to the meetings and had a place to voice their concerns. You know, one of the things for me that I always like to say is that if you have a complaint, you have a right to come in and tell me every single day. If it takes 3 months, it's my job to keep listening.
This is true. Yeah, this is true.
So that's when we met, Nawar, and we've been friends ever since. But I ended up moving to Dahuk, and I haven't seen you in quite some time. But you've still been working in Erbil, and now what is your role now?
Well, after working with IFC, so I quit the job with IFC because, this is something I might mention, like focus more on when talking about the trip to Italy. But in a way or another, like with IMC, which is like amazing team, the colleagues were there, but amazing. But like I had the chance as a local, I couldn't have the chance as expat, which is really I am. It's just like because like when you say local means like you already have your house there. You don't have to rent a house. You have your transportation means, let's say, could be whatever, but like once you are expat but considered as local, it's just like kind of not fair. Also in terms with like many things, it's just like, you know, it's just like at the end you find it's just like the baggage that you have as a local while you are an expat is just like not, you cannot really.
So what happened is you were working for IMC as a local or a national staff, but you had an opportunity to work with TDH, which I can't say Terres de Homes because I don't speak Italian or French. You know, I can't do it. How do you say it?
Terre des Hommes in Italian and Terre des Hommes in French.
And so you work with them because you were able to get an expat contract. So they're recognizing that you are not an Iraqi, that you're not a local or national staff, that you're from outside. And that means that you you are now provided housing and you have all the other benefits of somebody who is not from Iraq, that doesn't have a stable, like their base is not Iraq.
This is true. And like if you go back a bit, like before working with IMC, I used to work with Panasonic company and I was considered as an expat. So I get the house, like the flat, I get the transportation, like I had a car to move. So it was very good. Also, the salary was higher for that time. But at that moment, I thought that I want to do something for Syrians, like more focusing on this topic. But then at the end, like when you provide... when you do this for a year and then like you just like you recognize that you really cannot stay like keep doing this with what you have
right, you have to make a living, like you have to move, exactly. You have to
exactly. So one of the reasons that I moved from IMC was this, plus like Terre des Hommes was more specialized with child protection, which is like the sector that I like. Or
yeah, that's what you're really good at.
Yeah, exactly. This sector plus livelihood and education. And these like three sectors weren't exist with IMC. Like they were in a way or another, but not focusing on it. Like so when we talk protection and IMC, it's like in general. So we do some small projects for child protection or for protection in general and GBV. While with Terre des Hommes was like more focusing on this field, which I really like.
So then let's move then to the recent trip, Noir, you just recently took to Italy. I think that was in April.
In March 2016.
Okay, in March 2016, recently.
Ended in April, so you're kind of true.
Yeah, it was a long trip, and you were going on, you have an R&R. So basically, for all of us who are humanitarian workers, we have like mandatory R&Rs, and that's so that we get some breaks to go refresh ourselves mentally and to catch up with the primary reason is so that you can see your family again.
Yeah, this is true.
Which for me is difficult because my family's so far away, so I hardly ever go home. But you chose to go to Italy.
Yeah, I chose to go to Italy. It was kind of, I was supported by the HQ of Terre des Hommes.
The headquarters, because they're based in Italy.
Yeah, they are based in Italy, Milano. So they sent me the invitation letter, and then like I started to do some procedures to get the visa as a Syrian to Italy, which is like something now considered as one of the impossible things that you could do as a Syrian. Anyway, within a month, I get the visa, and then went to Italy. At that time with my girlfriend, and we spent some time in Rome, and then after to Venice. Later, I had to move from Venice to Milano to have a meeting with the HQ after my girlfriend left.
So what was that like for you, those 10 days or however long you were in Italy?
Well, yeah. For me, it just like was my dream always to visit Italy, in particular Rome, Venice, these two cities. So it was amazing feeling. In Rome, it's just like full of tourists. So, you know, it's just like every third person could be a tourist. So I think people who live in Rome just like get bored of talking to strangers, so really like you couldn't easily communicate with them. Some of them super nice, some of them is just like you feel like really they live in different worlds, just like they are not in Rome, although that looks like this person lives in this street, but like if you ask about something in the streets would say no, just because of meeting a lot of people on daily pace or like every hour, let's say.
And you told me that people actually, when you were with your girlfriend, people thought you were Italian. But then when you weren't with your girlfriend, they immediately would like speak to you in Arabic.
Yeah, or like maybe because they don't know the language, the Arabic, but they would recognize easily that I'm from Arabic country. And then, like, once you say, like, I'm from Syria, so they look like, okay, so you are one of the refugees who crossed the sea by boat, or maybe one of the refugees who crossed Europe walking or something. What a hard trip you got. They don't really know, just like, I came with the easiest way by just plane, by airplane. Mm-hmm.
So when they found out that you weren't a refugee, did it change how they talked to you?
Well, in a way or another, like at the beginning, like when they know that they're like, I'm Syrian or something, just like at the beginning, you could see this kind of feeling, like they feel sorry a bit for me or something. And like, but when directly saying like, okay, so you try to put some sentences that, yeah, you know, once I entered the airport, it was super easy to enter. So you came by, you know, just like...
So you try to sneak it into the conversation.
Exactly. I tried to sneak it into the conversation to just like to say like, I'm not a refugee here or something. Just like, I'm here for R&R or for vacation. And then like they start to talk about like more, they feel more comfortable to talk about what's going on in Syria or the situation of refugees. But at the beginning, you could easily like see that when they talk to you, it's just like they are not feeling comfortable. Either they like it or no, but whether they like it or no, it's just for them, they don't really feel comfortable to talk to a Syrian guy who just arrived, because maybe for the last year, a lot of Syrians just arrived in illegal ways and seeked asylum or something. So I tried to sneak it at the beginning, but then like just like I started to feel okay, like I should say it frankly. I was just like, yeah, I'm from Syria, you know, from Damascus, but not refugee. I'm here for vacation for a couple of weeks to spend it in Italy, because it's a dream it's my dream to visit Rome. So at the end, it's just like I get bored of sneaking it every single time in the conversation. Just like say it frankly and khalas, you know, whatever.
Khalas means finished.
Yeah, khalas means finished or enough, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I think you told me you had plans to go to France.
Yeah, this is true. I had plans. So after finishing the meeting in the HQ with my boss, I planned to go to France, Munich, Berlin, Amsterdam by train. And that was the plan, to have the train every night. So I sleep in the train, so I don't have to find a house or something. You know, I don't need to do such a thing.
No hotel.
Because we used to, like my girlfriend and I, we used to rent through Airbnb. And in Milano, when I was by myself, I also like I had to find something to stay for 3 nights. So I went through Airbnb. But for the other trip, I really wanted to do kind of road trip by train. So I thought, okay, I would choose one of these slow trains that they offer you like a place to sleep or something. And then in the morning, I wake up in a city and I get down and just like explore the city, let's say, or wander the city around. And then like in the night, I get the next train to the other city or something. However, an explosion happened in Brussels.
In Brussels, the not just an explosion, like the two big at the airport and at the subway in Belgium.
Exactly, in Belgium, in Brussels, and it was a day before leaving Milano. So the recommendation was from my colleagues and my boss in the HQ told me, no, I was just like, if you want to go to anywhere, just you go by plane, by air, not... Don't go by train, because there are going to be a lot of checkpoints. Although that you have the Schengen visa on your passport, they might ask you to go back, or maybe they deport you out of Europe, directly send you to Iraq or something. And you don't want to be in this.
And that's because that basically suspicions would be high of people from the Arab world.
Exactly. It's just like, in a way or another, yes, it's exactly.
Because and how did that make you feel?
Well, it makes me like, how would that makes you feel, Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't like it, but I'm just saying, like, I don't know. I want to know what you happen to be there, but you don't normally live in Europe, so.
it's a horrible feeling. Mm-hmm. But the point is that also it makes you feel like it's just like unfair world, because if now we talk about ISIS, you could see a lot of expat ISIS members, like which are from USA, from UK, from Belgium, from Europe in general, you know. So anyone, white or black, green, yellow, whatever is the color, whatever is the language, could be an ISIS member. Mm. This is that, because it's kind of global organization. Yes, I know that ISIS exists in Iraq, Syria, Libya, these countries which are recognized as Arab countries, but then and most of the members are Arabs or Islamic people, but are they really Arab, or do they believe of being Arab or Muslims? It's just like the point is no. When you go into this, the answer is no, obviously.
Mm. What you're saying is that they're not true Muslims, right?
Not true Muslims, not true Arab, let's say, or something. This is like kind of something they were born with, but that's it. In the ID, you could find it, but that's it.
You mean like we would call that like being a nominal Christian is what my friends would be able to understand that as. You just have the name of it, but it means you're not really a part.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's the same thing that when you talk about some of these Christian organizations in Africa. But then, are they Christian, real Christian? No.
I don't know what you're talking about.
They use, yeah, these kind of Christian groups in Ghana or Cameroon or these.
Oh, do you mean the militias, like Christian militias?
Exactly. Yeah, the Christian. Or like, let's talk about these are who are in India now or Myanmar that they treat Muslims in bad way or something. So are they representing
their religion, right? Yes, I see what you're saying.
This is what I'm saying. So I wouldn't consider these people represent Christianity, because we know Christianity is about mercy, about love. Also, the Buddhian religion. I don't know the religion of Buddha. Yeah,
Buddhism.
Buddhism, and or Judaism.
Judaism,
like all these religions, if you look at them, there is the mercy, there is love in it. So whoever kills by the name of one of these religions shouldn't be considered as one of these religions. It's just like, it should be obvious as, just like that.
Right. So it was a horrible feeling to know that people might be looking at you differently, or even to be afraid of you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would give you a kind of example here or story. When I arrived to Germany, I bought this Panasonic Camiro, and I get this bag for it.
It's like a large, like a nice camera, right?
Yeah, a nice Camiro. And then like the bag of it is just like kind of, like the size of it could be whatever, you know, just like not that big bag, not a backpack, but also not small bag for small cameras. No, just like the size of, let's say, 30 centimeter, the high and the width is like about 20 centimeters. So you could hide a lot of things inside it.
Right. You bought this camera bag so that you could carry other things in it besides your camera, right?
Exactly. Like my wallet, like my phone, like, you know, many different things that you could.
A man purse. Basically, you bought a man purse and you disguised it as a camera bag.
Well, I'm not going to do it. Like, I'm not going to describe it like this or no, because I know it's not that cool. But in general, but yes, you could put some stuff while holding your camera, while carrying your camera as well.
And so then, but like you thought that carrying the camera bag was making people more afraid.
Yeah, well, so this is the story here. Like whenever I use the metro, underground metro in Germany, as example, in Berlin. So I could easily notice that some people are looking at me in just like different way, and sometimes looking at my camera. They might or not, but maybe just I imagined this, maybe. So I thought maybe like they are scared about like having this guy, which is obviously not from Germany, not from Europe, you know, and my skin is not like, I'm not black, not that dark, but not white as well. So holding this bag. It could be something scary for them. So it was funny that sometimes I had to open my bag every single time, just like to take out the camera, pretending that I'm watching something, or just like to make them feel comfortable, you know, that I'm not holding any of these materials. Just like I have just only camera in this bag. And then it was funny because, like, when you go for a place that's about, like, 6-7 stations or stops or something, and then every stop you have to get, some new faces are there. So, again, like, every single time you have to put the camera and then take it out. And then, because if you keep the camera outside, so for the person who comes into the train again, like a new one, wouldn't know what is in the bag. And wouldn't know that the camera was in the bag. And then if you keep the camera inside, and for the person again who comes into the train, like as a new arrival or whatever, it's just like doesn't know what is in the bag. So you have to open the bag again and just to show the camera, pretending you are watching something, and then like put it back. It was crazy as that for 2 days. But then I decided, okay, I should be the only one who feels comfortable. I don't really care. They should feel glad that they were with a Syrian guy in a tram holding a bag. God knows what is in the bag, and they survived. They should feel glad, and that will give them an amazing feeling after. So I tried, not opening the bag anymore. It's just like, because it doesn't make me feel comfortable at the end, you know?
Okay, so I'm laughing as you're telling this story, but it really isn't funny. But I'm laughing at this, like you're taking responsibility to help other people feel safe. So every time someone new comes on to the metro, you are trying to show them without saying anything again that there's a camera in the bag, right?
This is true. I was tiring for 2 days or 3 days being in Germany.
Like, I only know how that feels a little tiny bit, because I often worry about what other people think of me for, like, none of the same reasons, just for really, like, horrible, selfish reasons, I think. Like, what's that person thinking? And then I don't know, I try to do something that would show that I'm actually a good person or something. But yeah, to do that, just to ride, just to get to where you're going, and to have to do that over and over again, is so, I don't know. And then I love that you just decided, I actually can't do this. I can't make everyone feel safe
anymore. Yeah, I cannot make people feel safe every single second I'm around them.
Yeah.
But I could make them, as I told you, I could make them glad after that. Yeah. Nothing happened to them after meeting me. So this is the other feeling, which I was convinced that, okay, so let's giving them this good feeling instead of that one, you know?
No. Oh, yes.
Well, I was just wondering, so that was you're talking about your experience on this holiday, something that you've always wanted to do, go on this holiday, you're visiting places that you'd always wanted to see.
Yeah.
But you had this other narrative happening of what people think when they see you traveling. So how did that affect your overall experience of this vacation?
Well, also, like, I kind of felt like I'm representing my country. Mm-hmm. In a way or another, I'm representing the refugees who are already there. So I wanted kind of to show that Syrians are nice, are well educated. Sometimes I have to pretend things just like to show them that we could easily cope with the society there. I know that, like, as example, and this is another story, like in Middle East, in Syria, it's the traffic, as example, is well organized. But here in Iraq, it's just like, or at least here in Erbil, it's just like you cross the street from the, like, any place you could see, you find yourself in the middle of the street, it's just like the only way to cross the street. Anyway, when I went to Europe, it's just like I was waiting for every single red traffic light to become green, and then I cross, just like to show that we easily can cope with this society.
That you guys can follow the rules.
Exactly, we can easily follow the rules. Although that sometimes I could find, like, the streets were totally empty, no one is there, but the traffic light is red. and I had to wait just like to get the traffic light becomes green. There is the button, sometimes you could press it and just like wait to become green and then you walk. I didn't want to use that one because I didn't want to, in my opinion, to confuse the traffic lights around or something. So I thought, okay, I'm going to wait for 10. Although that I saw some local people like from Italy, from Germany, that they crossed the street even when it's red. And was something amazing. I've never seen this before in the Middle East world, let's say. Like once you put your foot to cross the street or something, so all the cars, they stop, even if it's red. If it's red for you or like it's green for the cars. So that was amazing. So people could just like easily move. Sometimes I felt like it's not fair for the cars because it's their turn, but they had to stop.
No, then, I think you're just like a very compassionate person in general. Like you care about everybody. You care about the cars. You care about everything.
Well, it's just like this is the way how to live. It's just like, you know, but sometimes it's tiring, Jen, by the way. It's really tiring. It's just like when
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, let's say like a week ago, I kind of had, what do you call it in English? Like self, like I was thinking about every single thing in myself.
You were being self-reflective, is what we say?
Yeah, it could be like self-reflective. Like I'm trying to just like, again, like review what I'm doing, my personality, and what I should stop, what I should take care of, what should I not, you know? About my well-being as well, I have to take care about this regardless, as long as I'm not damaging the freedom of the others or like not affecting the freedom of the others. So I started to do this like, let's say, a week ago, exactly by the end of April, the beginning of May. One of the results that, you know, that I'm quitting smoking, as example.
Congratulations.
And trying to find, you know, these breaks to smoke, 5 minutes, 10 minutes for smoking. I started to use them for reading.
That's really great.
Yeah, because for the last 7-8 months, I stopped reading because I don't know, like what happened. I stopped reading as I used to before. And then, okay, I'm going to use this 10 minutes for break for cigarettes. I'm going to use it now for reading instead or doing something else. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I'm going to start to think about my well-being sometimes, like more. I mean, I'm not going to be that selfish, but yes.
Yeah, that's really important, I think, especially in the humanitarian field. Like,
yeah.
It's very easy to work all night, you know, to just always be serving other people. But that's really great.
Yeah. One of the questions, you know, in the humanitarian field, I provide trainings about psychosocial support and psychological first aid. Anyway, in the training, I start with the training with the trainers, telling them, I want you to be selfish in this work. And then they really don't like the idea. There is a question, you know, sometimes to evaluate the performance of the trainers, we do pre-post tests for them.
A pre-test and a post-test.
Pre-test and post-test. So to evaluate their performance during the training.
Yeah, to see what they learned.
Yeah, exactly. To see the improvement in their knowledge or something. So one of the questions like is, you as humanitarian worker, you should not respond to the tiring signals in you, and you should focus on the others that you are provide, the beneficiaries that you are providing services for them.
So you shouldn't focus on like the warning signals that exactly, like on your own burnout. You shouldn't focus on burning out yourself, but you should focus on the people you're serving. That was the question.
That was the question, and they should answer yes or no. And like every single trainer wrote no. So they should yes, we should not focus on the warning signals. We have to focus on the people, which is the wrong answer because we have to focus on ourselves first. And then, like, we focus on the beneficiaries.
Yeah, and I think that's a problem for both national staff and international staff.
And international staff, yeah. I started to recognize, I have, like, kind of a short story for this, but, yeah. A year ago, we were providing these kind of services, now focus on ourselves. And then, when I received this training and started to train these people, I just recognized that, no, we have to help ourselves first, to focus on ourselves first, and then and our colleagues, and then we have to think about the beneficiaries, because otherwise you would provide really bad services, or you could deal with beneficiaries in a really bad way just because you didn't respond to these warning signals in yourself.
Yeah. Well, Noir, I think we're coming to the end of our time. Is there anything else that you would want to share with the people who are listlistening?
Well, no, I just I want to thank you, Jennifer, Jessica, a lot for having me this. It was amazing that we are talking here. The thing that I want to share with everybody is I just really want to deal, I want them to deal with refugees as human, and that's it, you know? Just they don't deal with them according to their background, nationality background, religion background. Just deal with them as human, because they are you and you are them. It's just you. There should not be they and we, you know? It's just we all, and that's it.
Absolutely. So, I think that's one of my key messages. If my life could say anything, I would want it to say that it's not us against them.
Exactly. It's just please. They used to live an amazing life before. They wouldn't love to leave their houses to come to your countries or something, but the war enforced them to do. So give them the chance to be all one society, one community. They might go back to their houses when the war ends or something, but also they can contribute to your society, to your community in really effective and creative way.
Well, thanks so much, Noir. I hope that we get to do this again.
I hope so, too.
Yeah, thank you. This was such a beautiful conversation. You touched on so many things that I would love to spend much more time talking to you about. But thank you for sharing what you did.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. It was also meaningful for me. And thank you so much for you both, Jennifer and Jessica.
Well, if you're just tuning in again, this is Voices from the Road, and I'm Jennifer Robinson. I just started this podcast since I've taken a break from humanitarian work, and I'm on a road trip, so I'm just doing this with my friends because I think everyone's stories are so unique and special and have a message to tell. If you've missed past episodes, you can find them on iTunes, Voices from the Road, and you can also subscribe. So please, if you don't want to miss more interviews like this one, subscribe, and hopefully we'll be able to talk with Noir again. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day.